The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Harry Reid has been in office, if my math is correct, for nearly 40 years. In that time, he has moved from Nevada State Assembly to the United States Congress to the position of Senate Majority Leader that he holds today. In his new book, The Good Fight, Hard Lessons from Searchlight to Washington, Senator Reid traces the arc of his personal life and career as they intertwine to tell a distinctly American tale. He'll be interviewed today by Philadelphia Inquirer national political columnist Dick Pullman, who has been called one of the finest political journalists of his generation. Please welcome Senator Harry Reid and Dick Pullman.
This on? This is on. All right. Well, I'll welcome everybody and thank you all for braving the weather, and if any of you drove, braving the traffic restrictions today as well. That's better. Well, we're here with Senator Harry Reid, and his book, his memoir, is upstairs. If anybody's interested in it. So what we're going to do here is try to have a somewhat informal conversation for the first half hour, the Senator and I, after that, for the second 30 minutes, we're going to open it up to questions from you all. And anybody who has a question, there'll be microphones moving around. So if there's anything that we say that brings a question to mind, hold on to it. Presumably, you might have come in with some as well. And make it in, as we always say, make it in the form of a question and avoid speeches, and that way everybody can get the most time in. I want to talk just briefly first, Senator, about the book, which is the reason you're here in town, the memoir. And I was just curious, I mean, what strikes me about it more than anything, obviously, I mean, there are so many political memoirs that get churned out every year. But there are very few which talk about someone's upbringing from by alcoholic parents, growing up in a shack without indoor plumbing, and a number of amazing details in your early life. And yet you say in the book at one point, I believe, that, or you maybe remarked this in an interview, that you're not confessional by nature, I think was the phrase. Why at this particular time did you choose to do this memoir?
Probably two reasons. One is when I was born in Searchlight. In the state of Nevada at that time, there were 100,000 people at the most. It's now a state of about 3 million people. I've been in public life for quite a number of years now in Nevada, and a lot of people don't know who I am. They see my name in the newspaper, television, radio. And that's what they know about me. It's the same on a national level. Now that I'm a figure who people read about in newspaper and magazines and that kind of thing, do they really? They don't know who I am. So that's one reason I wrote the book. The other reason I wrote the book is as I went away from Searchlight in high school, young boy, 13, 14 years old. I went away to college, law school, practiced law, entered public service. And during all those years, Searchlight was something that was kind of an embarrassment to me. You can see the picture in the book where I was born, raised in a home very similar to that. My parents, as I indicate in the book, were uneducated. My dad didn't graduate from the eighth grade. My mother never graduated from high school. You've described my home, outside toilet. One teacher taught all eight grades. The number one business was no longer mining, it was prostitution. I learned to swim in a bordello swimming pool. So it was something I wanted to put behind me and really not think much about it, which I didn't. But then I came as a young adult and then some to the realization that that's who I was. That you can't run from who you are. So I just put my arms around Searchlight and who I turned out to be and proceeded to... I wrote the first and only history of Searchlight, published by the University of Nevada Press. And that was hard work. I did it when I was in the Senate. It took me a couple of years, nights and weekends and holidays. It was very difficult. A history book is a book that you have to have, protect your sources, make sure you know if somebody's going to be looking at it later and they want to be able to have accuracy in that. And so the second reason in this long narrative is that I want when people read this book to understand what I tell kids in Nevada and have told them for years. If I can make it in America, anyone can. And I really think this book lays out what a wonderful country America is. If a guy like Harry Reid can make it, anyone can. And one of my goals as a national legislator is to continue the ability of people in America to work through this process and get an education like me. Hopefully not as many hurdles as some have, but to recognize that America is a wonderful country. So those are the two reasons I wrote the book.
There's you mentioned one thing I was going to point out, which was I think I ran across this around page 24. Certainly an arresting phrase for any reader, which was, I think I have it here, "I learned to swim at a whorehouse." And, I mean, some cynics might think that's a perfect way to negotiate one's way through the U.S. Senate, but...
It hasn't hurt.
But certainly in this political season where everybody's throwing around the word elitist, nobody can throw it at you in that sense. I was wondering, what did you learn in those early years, what did you learn about human nature that you think you've carried forward and made use of during your career in the Senate?
That's a question that, since writing this book, that I've thought about. And there are a number of things that I think are important, being raised the way I was with parents who, as I indicate in the book, drank too much and fought too much. Family's really important. And I came to the realization as a young person, even though I couldn't figure out in my mind really what I wanted and what I understood, is that government's important. My grandmother, the only grandparent I knew was my grandmother on my father's side. She was so nice to me and used to talk to me and tell me stories. She had 8 children, none of whom had anything materially, but because of her, as she referred to it, her old age pension check, she was independent. That's Social Security. That's why I fought Bush so hard in trying to privatize Social Security, is because there are many people just like my grandmother. So family and government, I believe in the law. As I talk about in the book very briefly, Big John Silvera was the cop, the sheriff in Searchlight. He was it. He carried his gun in the glove compartment, and when he got out of the car, he stuck it in his back pocket. And out on the road between Las Vegas and Searchlight, a man had been driving drunk, flipped his car over, killed him. Big John came to me and my friend Leland, and he said, "I want to take you for a ride." Put his, cop car out, we went. So we had this dead man laying on the ground. He said, "See him?" That's what happens when you are drunk and you drive. Yeah, that I've always remembered that. So that's respect for law enforcement, government, and family.
I noticed in the book, around page 100, you mentioned being student body president at your high school, student body president. And that made me wonder, and this maybe is in the book, I might have missed it, but I'll ask the question for everyone here. I mean, when did you first... were you interested in politics at that point, or was it just as much a popularity contest? I guess what I'm getting at is, what do you think would you consider your earliest formative experiences or exposures to politics that got you interested in pursuing it?
I really had none. There was nothing in Searchlight. My goal in life was to be a baseball player, athlete. And that came to an end my freshman year in college when I realized I wasn't good enough, fast enough, or big enough to be the athlete of my dreams. But my political, let's talk just briefly on that. I came over from Searchlight. My mother ordered all my clothes out of a catalog. And so I was dressed differently than the other kids. My hair was combed differently than the other kids. But people were very nice to me. And let me give you the first example of how one thing can change your life, for good or bad. I was a freshman in high school. I wanted to be this athlete. And they pass out the equipment. They give you a bag of stuff. And next to my locker was a transfer student who was a junior in high school. His name was Eddie Johnson, a handsome young man and a good athlete. He became the quarterback on the football team, and was a third baseman we won the California State Championship with him at third base. I didn't know what an athletic supporter was. I'd never seen one. I didn't know what it was. So the man next to me in the locker, the boy, said, "What is this?" And he told me what it was in a very nice, quiet way. Think what he could have done to me and my ego by, "Hey, look at this jerk here. He doesn't even know what a jock strap is." I was treated so well, as I look back, being kind of an odd guy coming into the fold. The most important election of my life was a junior in high school. I was elected junior class treasurer. Now, that might not seem like much to most people, but for me, I felt that I was finally accepted. My peers had finally accepted me. I was junior class treasurer. So that's the beginning of my political career.
I noticed in the book that you were also involved in Young Democrats at Utah State. What was it that, I'm not familiar with Nevada politics at that period. What shaped you as a Democrat? Was it John F. Kennedy, for example, that period?
No, it wasn't.
Prior to that.
In Searchlight, there were no church services. There was no church. The closest we came to religion in my home, because religion was never a discussion ever in our home. Our little house, my mother had a blue pillowcase, no pillow in it, but a blue pillowcase, royal blue with gold fringe, hung it on the wall. And it said, "We can, we will, we must. Franklin Delano Roosevelt." That's the closest I ever came to religion. And so that, my dad used to talk about going around bumming during the Depression, trying to find work. And the affection that my parents had for Roosevelt. So I was a Democrat. That's the way it was because of my religion. And Searchlight, Roosevelt. So I went to Utah State, then not the right-wing conservative state that it is now, because they elected Democrats back then a little bit. But at Utah State University, I formed the first Young Democratic Club on campus ever. And I have in my Washington office, and anyone that ever comes there, you can drop in and see it on my wall, a letter from President Kennedy. Between the time he had been elected and by the time he was inaugurated, he sent me a letter saying, "Thanks for doing this at Utah State, and look forward to meeting you someday," you know, that kind of thing. So that's one of my prized possessions. And Ted Kennedy has looked at the letter, and he said that's his signature, and that wasn't signed by someone else.
This may be an awkward segue. I want to jump way ahead in time, but to bring much more to the present, is it fair to say then that election is a class treasurer, your junior in high school, in some ways was more personally satisfying than becoming ascending the Senate Majority Leader in 2007.
Yeah. In many ways it was. That's right. Becoming the Majority Leader, I'd really been prepared for that. I wasn't prepared for Daschle losing, but I'd really been prepared for moving up one notch. I was Assistant Leader for 6 years, And I'd lived on the Senate floor for 6 years. I changed the role of the whip or the assistant leader. So, you know, it was very gratifying that my colleagues would choose me to be their leader. But really that, as a teenage boy, looking around saying, you know, I'm one of them, that really made me feel good.
Everybody has a blog now. Probably half the audience has a blog. But yesterday when I mentioned this event, some people posted comments, and two or three of them had an urgent question that they wanted me to ask. And, of course, this question will not shock you at all. But how do you deal with the frustrations or disappointments or even anger from Democratic base voters who elected Democratic Congress in 2006 with the expectation of bringing the war to an end, or at least curbing it substantially? Mm-hmm. Is it enough to say that you just don't have the votes?
No, I think it's fair to say that I share their disappointment. It was a surprise to most pundits, in fact, 90% of them. For 2 months, there was talk all over the media that Pelosi was going to be the next speaker. But you'd have to search long and hard to find anything that said the Democrats would take the Senate. It was really, we won a lot of very close races, Montana, Virginia, Missouri. We had some real close calls, and Rhode Island. So when I became the leader, we had the majority, 51-49. Before the 9 new Democratic senators were sworn in, though, Tim Johnson, South Dakota senator, got very sick. He was in a coma for 5 weeks, out of work for 10 months. So my majority dropped from 51-49 to 50-49. And then, bango, what happened? Joe Lieberman votes with Republicans on everything relating to the war, everything on us with other things, but the war he voted with them. So I had no majority. It was 49 us, 50 or 51 them. So it was a difficult time. In spite of that, we had 37 votes on changing course in Iraq. I don't regret one of those votes. The most votes we were able to get is 57. We needed 60. But we were able, though, to change the course in many different ways. We were the ones that got body armor for the troops. We're the ones that got up-armored the vehicles. We're the ones that moved in to take care of the medical problems these returning veterans were having and to lessen the scandal at Walter Reed. So the people that blogged back had every right to say, well, why didn't they do more? But that's the best we could do. The majority just simply wasn't there.
Was the I seem to remember, and maybe your memory of this is different, but I do seem to remember that during the 2006 election season, there was a sense, the message from a lot of the candidates, and Democratic candidates were, in both House and Senate, was elect a Democratic Congress, and we're gonna put it to Bush, and we're gonna get this war stopped or curbed. And was there? I mean, I know a lot of that's campaign rhetoric, but when you look back, do you have any sense that perhaps people's expectations were raised too high?
I think they were raised higher than they were raised no higher than the expectations of us making the statements, because realistically, I always believed that there would be a few Republicans who would join with us in anything like that. And I was right. I just didn't realize how few. we had a few brave souls march over the line, led by Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, who gave up his career as a matter of principle. But we could never get above 57. As you know, I've called the Republicans in the Senate puppets of President Bush, and that's really what they've been, because they have followed him on everything, and on the war especially. So people have a right to be disappointed. I'm disappointed. But I think the expectations were not based upon fluff. I think the expectations were based upon statements that people made, believing that they could do something about it.
Well, I'll let you run wild on this answer. Many of us were also anticipating after 2006 that, given the polls, perhaps even in their own back states, that a lot of these Republicans in the Senate were going to start peeling away. I mean, there was a broad expectation that that was going to happen with just more than one or two. Despite the president's falling fortunes, continuously falling fortunes, particularly in 2007 and onward, what explains, in your mind, the reason why so many of them have stuck with the White House on the war anyway?
I think the hole has been dug so deep that they can see nothing to do but keep digging. These people early on signed their own death warrants as far as elections go. If the election were held today, we would pick up a significant number of seats in the Senate. We have 11 seats competitive. We think we're now competitive in Texas, so we're now at 12. We've had two polls this week that show us 4 points behind John Cornyn in Texas. So they've created their own problems politically, but they, I believe, just felt that they're in this hole, and if they try to start figuring a way to get out of it, they only exacerbate the picture that how they got in the hole in the first place. So I just think they kept saying, well, you know, this surge is going to turn things around, and there's going to be victory in Iraq, and we'll be just fine. But that doesn't take into consideration why they've done other things they've done. I mean, there's so many things. How could they possibly vote for this? I thought one of the things we could get done, the Medicare bill that Bush pushed through, had a provision in it that, and it was a big wet kiss to the health insurance industry and to the managed care industry. They, in that legislation, legislated that Medicare could not negotiate for lower-priced drugs. Now, we should be able to change that. I mean, how can you put Medicare at such a disadvantage? We couldn't get 60 votes to change that. And right now, Medicare cannot negotiate for lower-priced drugs. All the insurance companies can, the managed care entities can, but not Medicare. And there are many other things that are stunning that they have stopped. In 10 months, the Republicans broke the 2-year record of filibusters. So we've been able to accomplish quite a bit with very, very many procedural obstacles, and it's been difficult. They have filibustered things they agree with. To stall for time.
Is it? And you don't have to elaborate on this too much. But is it realistic to think? You mentioned 11 or 12 states that the Democrats are competitive in this fall in Senate races, which often get overlooked in a presidential year, attention-wise. And you would need
nine
to get to 60 in order to get most legislation passed. Mm-hmm. Is it realistic to think that you can win nine out of 12?
You know, I am always someone who is called a pessimist because that way I'm not disappointed very much. So I think that we're going to pick up some seats. I'm going to downplay it. I think we can get 4 or 5. That would give me a significant majority. That would get me up to 56 or so. That would be very, very nice. But we'll have to wait and see what happens. New Hampshire, we would win that today. Virginia, we would win it today. New Mexico, we would win it today. Probably Colorado, we're 10 points ahead in Alaska right now. We're probably going to win North Carolina and beat Elizabeth Dole. We have Lawton Child's niece running there. She's a state senator. She's extremely good. We have, as we speak, in Mississippi, Musgrove is tied with Wicker. So, I mean, we have opportunities all over the country.
Of course, it would also help.
If I could just also say this, Dick, and I'm anticipating a question that some of you may have, and I'll just respond to it this way. I am not one that laments the long Democratic primary that's taken place. And the reason I say that is that, excuse me, I've got a little of your Philadelphia hay fever. Nevada, for the first time in a generation, we have tens of thousands of more Democrats than Republicans. Right here in Pennsylvania, first time in the history of this state, more than 4 million registered Democrats. It's that way all over the country. The primary has been good for open discussion of issues. Obama and Clinton have had about 25 national debates. That's wonderful. We have young people involved for the first time in a long time in politics. College campuses are alive with activities for Obama and Clinton. And we didn't change the law in Washington as to how campaigns are going to be financed. It was done by American people over the Internet. Obama is an example. Clinton's raised as much, but not as much. He's raised about $130 million. The average contribution is $90. It's remarkable.
Did you, all right, we can pursue that question for a second. I mean, I had a couple questions about the news, of course, in the last few days. Is it, and I think you're on record as saying this, that you anticipate that there'll be some kind of resolution of this contest by June?
Yeah, what I've said the last couple of weeks is that Bill Clinton did not receive the nomination until June 2nd. So people need just to be patient, let this play out a little bit. June 3rd is the last primary. I have said that Obama and Clinton will have a couple days to make their case to those superdelegates who are not committed. And within a couple days after June 3rd, we're going to have our nominee, unless something happens beforehand. Excuse me. We'll have a five-month general election. That's as much as American people need or want. So I think we're okay. And I have, because I am the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, I've been very neutral. I want to be able to, whoever comes back, look that person in the eye, and I want them to know that I've been neutral, and I have been.
But doesn't it appear that the math would basic, the math of the delegates remaining and how they will align, doesn't it suggest, though, that if Senator Clinton was going to get this nomination, she would have to pursue it virtually all the way to the convention? And if you're basically saying that this would be over by June, I'm not saying you're rigging it for one candidate or another, but doesn't that basically suggest
even Terry McAuliffe,
he has the advantage?
Even Terry McAuliffe, and for those of you in the audience, there are a lot of people close to the Clintons, but I can't think of anybody closer than Terry McAuliffe. He said yesterday that it would be over a couple days after June 3rd.
Well, you are you're all looking here at a live, very live, a superdelegate right in front of you. We all hear some people in this audience, or maybe not this audience, but there are people in America who didn't really know what a superdelegate was as recently as two or three months ago. Now they know. You have, as you've said, as you are, of course, neutral. And I think you're also on record as saying that the superdelegates should do what they want in terms of who they vote for and presumably what criteria they may use. Now, as a superdelegate yourself, what criteria, when the time comes to make a choice, what criteria do you think is most relevant?
It's going to be so easy for me because I'm the last horse out of the chute, so it'll all be over with by the time I make my decision.
But is popular vote more important than electability?
I really believe it's up to the individual as to what they think. Remember, superdelegates only come from three places: members of the House of Representatives, members of the Senate, and members of the Democratic National Committee. That's the only place you can look for superdelegates. And let me end in a little secret here. They make all these fancy reasons why we have superdelegates, but the main reason we have superdelegates is because in years past, the two parties, the Republicans controlled by the radical right and the Democrats controlled by the extreme left. That's the way it's been most places in the country. And a lot of us felt uncomfortable going to have to romance a lot of people that we weren't in tune with politically. And these state party organizations would really humiliate elected officials. So they can't do that anymore. We go automatically to the convention. And that was one of the main reasons for that. No, I don't think anyone ever anticipated we'd be involved in selecting who the nominee would be.
We're going to go to questions in just a second. I just follow up one more, and then we'll turn it over to everybody in the audience. Well, on this question then of what happens next, there's been a lot of buzz, as always happens. Well, it's waxed and waned in the last few months, but there's more again this week about whether the best way and most practical way that the Democrats could win this election, after having this kind of incredible election season, would be that if Obama and Clinton are on the same ticket. There's been a lot of talk about it again the last few days. In fact, some people even connected with Senator Clinton have signaled that they think it's a good idea, although it's hard to know whether they're speaking for her or not. Do you think it's potentially a good idea?
I've had quite a few phone calls the last few days and a number of meetings with people suggesting that. There are only two people in the world who can solve that problem. It's Clinton and Obama. No one else can do it. I think it would be dangerous for someone to go suggest that to her. I think it would be dangerous for someone to go suggest that to him. The only people that can do that are the two of them.
The argument would be that there's a because of the incredibly intense feelings that have been stirred up in both their camps and the their factions that make up the Democratic coalition. On both sides, would be that if you put them together, that would be the best practical way that the Democrats could win in the fall. As you see it, would either of them be able to knit the Democratic coalition back together as effectively if they chose somebody else?
I believe whether they run together or one of them comes back to the Senate, that the party will be back pretty quickly. As I indicated, we have a lot of new people involved in politics now, especially young people. And for the first time in the history of the country, we have an African-American who is a viable candidate to be elected. We have, for the first time in the history, a woman running for president. So, I mean, it's a historic election, no matter what happens, and I think that Democrats will be united. And also the advantage that we have is John McCain's a flawed candidate. Everyone knows his temperament, that his work with him, and he's wrong on the war and wrong on the economy. So I think that we have several advantages going into this election season.
All right, I'm sure some of you might want to pick up on some of these aspects of the conversation. We have someone here with a microphone. So this gentleman here.
Thank you, Senator, for being here. I have a question which might kind of put you on the spot, but...
haven't been?
I know, this is for you.
Piece of cake question for me.
I'm concerned that the primary is more or less a popularity contest right now, and I'm very concerned about who would have the better opportunity to garner this presidential seat running against McCain. I'm very concerned that one or the other, I don't want to mention names, it would be much weaker against McCain, and we would stand a chance of having another Republican in the House.
Let me say this. I believe that... people have worked with Hillary and with Barack are immediately impressed with how bright they are, and that's an understatement. They both have a tremendous amount of depth intellectually. They have both had legislative experience. They are both hard workers. So I think they've got all the tools it would take to run. And again, I suggest that John McCain... Yeah, I kind of compare him to Governor Romney, and I do that for this reason. Governor Romney got a few hits because of his religion, but the problem with Romney was not his religion. It was he didn't know who he was politically. He was for abortion. He was against abortion. He was for immigration. He was against immigration. He was for gay marriage. He was against it. And if you look at John McCain's record, he's the same way. I mean, since he decided to put his arms around George Bush... He's no longer the independent on some issues he was before. He is a person who's looking for his identity to determine who he wants to be politically. And any time you do that, it's a weakness. I pride myself. I've had some pretty close elections in Nevada. But people never have to guess how I stand on an issue. And with John McCain, we're guessing now.
Assuming we get a Democratic president, which I think is quite possible, what What path do you see that we can get some major health care reform through Congress, and what lessons have we learned from the 90s?
I was in Washington when we tried to do health care, and it was destroyed by the insurance industry with the Helen and Louise, Harry and Louise ads. Okay, forget Harry. Harry and Louise ads. That program went from 80% popularity to 20%. It reversed by the time they ran all those ads. And I've described what they say what went wrong. Well, I think what went wrong is that this program was a freeway without a curve in the road, without a bump in the road. It was just too much, and it was easy to take apart. The two plans that Obama and Clinton have suggested are very similar. And we are at a point where we have to do something. I was at an event similar to this in New York. A man came to me, brought his daughter. I don't know how old she was, 25, 26. He said, she doesn't have any health insurance. And a lot of young people in America don't have health insurance because we know when we were young, we never got hurt, we never got sick, we thought we never would get in an accident. And those are the type of people that really need health insurance. So we have 50 million people that have no health insurance, almost 50 million people, and we have millions of others who are underinsured. So we have to do something. Major industrialized nation, we have to do it, not only for the directly what it does to our health care, but what it does for Medicare. There's a direct relation between the suffering of the Medicare program and having no health care generally. So, yes, we have to do something. We have to, and in the process, bring down the cost of medicine where America's cost charges. We pay far too much for the health care that we get. So, yeah, I'm very confident and hopeful we're going to get something done. But also let me explain this to everyone in the audience. Major changes in America with our system of government we have to come from the White House. It's the way it's always been. In the Roosevelt years, the Eisenhower, the reason we got the freeway system is because of Eisenhower. You cannot do this from Congress. We beat our chests and flex our muscles all the time. We can't do it alone. We need a White House. And whoever we get, whether it's Clinton or Obama, they're committed to health care reform. Can they do it in a year? Of course not. It's going to take some time to get this done. But they recognize the absolute necessity to get it done.
Whoa. I don't know. Let's just start back, and then we'll work back to the front since we've had two from the front.
Well, a guy in a uniform should at least have some advantage.
We're going that way as well. Go ahead, sir.
How about a guy in a uniform?
Yeah.
Oh, see, the guy has stripes on his arms.
My name is Walt Kernahan. You might not. It might not be good for me with you, Senator Reed. Number one is, I don't know how a man who's been a senator for 2 years could be qualified to be a president. And I don't know how a woman who's arrogant qualifies her to be president. Now, before you get any further, my father grew up from immigrants. He grew up in Germany. My father came here. His parents were immigrants from Ireland. They grew up with an outhouse outside their house. They only lived up here in Mount Airy. Okay? I've raised 5 kids, and I still have 2 at home. My oldest son here is running for state rep. But I'm curious how you can say that John McCain has flaws when Obama, he wants to change. How's a man with no power going to go to that state or that city and change this country? How is that woman going to change this country? Because I'm really totally confused.
Sure.
Okay? Now, before I got one more question. Why is it that politicians are quick to say nasty things about people in the military, but they're not quick to say nasty things about their own parties? What President Clinton did in office was a dirty, filthy, low-life thing. But none of you Democrats never say nothing about that. Okay? You tend to ignore it. But when somebody like John McCain, you sit there and you say John McCain has flaws? I'm not a John McCain fan. I'm a Romney fan. We have an economical problem in this country. Okay?
Well, you got 2 questions. Let me handle it.
Yeah, well, I got a lot of questions. I might take up too much of your time.
Well, I think why don't we let him handle those 2?
Once I get on a roll, I've served 31 years for this country. Okay? So I think I got a right to ask you more than one damn question.
I know, I gave you two.
Well, I got a right to ask you more than two.
Okay. Actually, we're going to be breaking up here in 20 minutes, so we're going to leave it at two. Why don't you unpack those, sir?
And I'll be happy to, I got staff here, whatever other questions you have, we'll make sure we take care of those. First of all, I don't know of anyone that would defend Bill Clinton and his situation with Monica Lewinsky. I've never heard anyone defend that. And I've said many, many times that I think Bill Clinton would go down as one of America's great presidents had that situation not developed, which put a kind of a cloud over everything he did. Let's just look at a little bit of his presidency. For the first time in many, many presidencies, Bill Clinton's budget deficit reduction plan in 1992 did just what he said it would do. The last 3 years of his presidency, we were spending less money than we were taking in. We were actually retiring the national debt. So that's pretty good. So that's enough defense of Clinton. But let me say this about John McCain. John McCain and I came to Washington together in 1982. So it's not as if I'm talking in a vacuum. I know John McCain pretty well. In fact, our seniority is separated by the population of the state of Arizona. There's more people in Arizona than Nevada, so he's one in the seniority a step ahead of me. I have stated here today as factually as I could that I believe that John McCain's stance on the war is not in keeping with the American people. I think that with that war costing us $5,000 a second, all borrowed money, Nobel Prize winning economist Stiglitz saying it's going to cost $3 trillion. We're approaching $1 trillion now. We've lost about 4,100 men and women there. We've had about 30 to 35,000 wounded, a third of them grievously wounded, blind, paralyzed. We have more than 3,000 double amputees. We have 20% of our troops coming home that have problems with their brain. So I think that that war is the worst foreign policy blunder in the history of our country. I say that in my book. I say it every opportunity that I get because I believe that. Now, let's talk about Clinton and Obama. We can talk about experience, and that's important in anything you do. But we can go back and look at some of the great presidents in the history of this country, Democrats and Republicans. Some of our really outstanding presidents have had very limited experience. Take Abraham Lincoln as an example. He was really unqualified to be president, but he turned out to be a wonderful president. In my book, one of the top three of all time. And there are other Lincolns. Dwight Eisenhower. I'm giving a couple of Republican examples. As far as government experience, he'd been a soldier. That's all he had done. Now, is that all? Well, he'd been a general officer. He had commanded the Allied invasion of Europe. So did he do well as president? Many people thought he did very well. I already mentioned the national highway system, one of the great things that this country has developed over the years. So I think that we can look at experience. It's important, but it's not the only thing. And about Clinton and Obama, I've mentioned their intellect is significant. They have had experience in government. Of course, have they served in Congress as long as John McCain? No. The first government job John McCain had, other than being in the military, was coming to Congress with me in 1982. So I really appreciate your 31 years of service to the country. And I would also acknowledge that we Democrats have really stepped up during this war, that a war that most of us don't agree with, in making sure the troops have everything they need. We are the ones, we Democrats are the ones that did everything that we could to make sure the troops had body armor. It wasn't right that parents were going to an Army surplus store, buying the equipment and sending it over to their troops. We're the ones that demanded up-armoring the vehicles. We're the ones that stepped in to lessen the scandal in the medical field at Walter Reed, taking care of veterans. We're the ones now pushing the GI Bill of Rights, the new GI Bill of Rights, written by Jim Webb, a decorated veteran from Vietnam. And why? Now, we're doing this because Colin Powell came out yesterday and said it's the right thing to do. Bush and McCain opposed this. So we're going to proceed forward. What we believe are principled stands. And as I've already indicated here, I think that either Obama or Clinton will beat John McCain in the general election. And that isn't any way to denigrate John McCain other than to talk the facts as I have.
Let's take over. Well, go ahead, sir, and then we're going to go over to this side of the room.
If the goal of the primaries is to select a candidate, why a convention?
I believe that we're going to have to change the system, and I'm hopeful and quite confident we will do it during this next four-year period of time. I think the present system is broken and needs to be fixed. The reason I say that is that this cycle has been much better than any we've had in modern times, and I've told you the reasons I feel that way. But until this year, until the DNC got more involved, we had Iowa, a state with not many people and almost no diversity, and New Hampshire, a state with no people and no diversity, determining who was going to be the President of the United States. And we had to change that. So we did change it. We changed it, not enough, but we changed it so that South Carolina and Nevada would be the first four. Why Nevada, some might say? Well, Nevada is really like the rest of this country. We have, it's a diverse, has a diverse population. 15% of it is union workforce. It's a state. Anyway, that's why it was chosen. South Carolina was chosen. What happened to Florida and Michigan? They tried to jump over everybody else. They wanted to be first. So during the next 4 years, what I'm saying we're going to change is we're going to change it, I hope, to set up a number of regional primaries so that we can have primaries around the country at different times, and then we would rotate every 4 years as to which one would be first. I think that's so important. Now, in answer to your question, why do we have the National Convention? The National Conventions aren't going to last much longer because they don't do much for anybody. By the time you get there, the nominee's already been chosen. In years past, that's where the nominee was chosen. That's why it was a McKinley or Harding. No, it was Wilson, President Wilson, Governor Wilson at the time, 44 different ballots at the Democratic National Convention to select him to be the presidential nominee. That was a lot of fighting going on. And yeah, well, I knew someone.
They lost that one.
Someone just told me the other day about Wilson, and I remembered that. Now, there are many people who nostalgically would like to go back to the old days. We had some pretty good nominees doing it the old way, smoke-filled rooms late at night. But we'll never go back to that. And I think what we're going to do, Dianne Feinstein is chairman of the Rules Committee. I've had a number of conversations with her, and I think we're going to change it, as I've suggested.
Let's go over this way. Yes. Yes, sir. And then we'll go right back.
I don't expect a long answer, but somewhere we came up with $1 trillion+ that's been reported to fight a war. And yet, in the years prior, it seemed like $3 million or $32 million for the National Endowment for the Arts or for infrastructure for the highway system that Eisenhower built were constantly fought, reduced, and we never could find any money. And it strikes me as, let me use the word confusing, that we can come up with $1 trillion to bomb a country that's already rocks into rocks, and I'm talking about Afghanistan, but we can't seem to come up with $150 or even $7 billion, and as you pointed out, that's less than a day, to put the bridges in Missouri in shape and Pennsylvania, to do something about the Schuylkill Expressway, where hundreds of millions of hours are spent uselessly. And I don't expect a long answer, but there must be some frustration amongst the Democrats and Republicans in the House about these kinds of issues. And I wonder if you could address it.
I wish that there was frustration among the Republicans. I think that's what they want. They want the status quo, and they voted accordingly. Last week, we had before the Senate the Federal Aviation Reauthorization Bill. Think about that, everybody. The Federal Aviation Reauthorization Bill. Right now, we have thousands of airplanes up there. The air traffic control system is not as good as the GPS on most of your cars. Okay? And that's the truth. Now, we had the FAA reauthorization bill up to create safety in our airports, to allow money to spend on redeveloping, reinvigorating our airports around the country. The Republicans killed this, killed it. We could not get a vote on it. We could not get 60 votes. I asked the Republican leader, I said, I understand what you don't like in this is $1.4 billion for the state of New York. When 9/11 occurred, George Bush, the president today, committed $20 billion. We authorized that much money. I said, Mitch, that's in the president's budget this year. He said, we still don't like it. So they killed it over that. And so everybody, when you go climb on an airplane, understand the Republicans who believe in the status quo have prevented us from doing that. We won't be able to do it this year. I mean, that is stunning to me. McCarran Airfield in Las Vegas, the fourth or fifth busiest airport in America. It's a new airport compared to a lot of them. They need money to do new things. They aren't going to have the money. It's a shame. But this, I think you say the Republicans feel bad about it. I don't think so.
Yes.
I'm hoping that Mr. Obama wins the election, and I'm hoping very much that you will see things my way. Beyond that, the centerpiece of his campaign has been a vision that we will do business differently. And if we do business differently, we can accomplish things that we've not been able to accomplish in recent years. And the Senate is not a place where rancor is not unknown, and where digging in is not unknown. And frankly, I think it's a miracle that a majority leader can even get from day to day. But assuming he wins, what specific things can a majority leader do to help things along so that things will be easier to get through that both sides might be called upon to agree on?
I have a number of things I am able to do because of the job I have. One is to set what we're going to be debating on a Senate at any given time. I'm the only one that can say we're going to do this or do that. So that's something, working with the president, that we'll do. I've tried to do that with this guy, but it hasn't worked. So with a little more manpower or woman power in the Senate, we're going to be able to do some good things with the president. You know, it's interesting. I've learned in the years that I've been a legislator. If you accomplish things, you know, there's credit to go around to everybody, Republicans, Democrats. If you're not getting things done, there's no credit at all. It's only blame. And so I am a believer that we're better off trying to accomplish things and try to pass out credit rather than trying to point blame. So I speak from experience that I would rather have it where we're accomplishing some things, and I think we can do that. One of the things I just want to comment briefly. We've always had the way the Founding Fathers set up our country. You know, there's constant battles going on between the three branches of government, separate but equal branches of government, but there are battles going on all the time as to create this equality. And in the legislative branch, there's always a battle going on between the House and the Senate. That's the way it is. As you know, in the past, somebody from the House came over and caned a senator and almost killed him. You know, we've had some difficult times in the Senate, not just recent years. But in modern times, one of the great disservices to the American public was Newt Gingrich. And the attitude that he developed of taking no prisoners, no cooperation, just push forward. And we have not purged ourselves from that yet, and we need to do that.
We have time for just a couple more questions. I think if anybody doesn't get called on, perhaps the senator might have a couple minutes when we break up. And I saw you had your hand up for a while.
I'm old enough to remember what John Nance Garner said about being vice president. He was vice president under Roosevelt in the first administration. Why would either Obama or Clinton want to be vice president?
That's an easy answer today because the role of the vice president has changed significantly over the years. It changed with when Nixon became president, he vice president. It changed dramatically, though, with Al Gore and Bill Clinton. And, of course, everyone knows that the president today is not Bush, it's Cheney. So there's a significant role for the vice president that didn't exist before. It's a powerful job anymore.
Last question, then those of you who I didn't get to call on, I'm sorry.
If you're not in a big hurry, I'll be happy to take a couple more questions.
I just want to take that one from the back because we haven't done anybody in the back.
Blue shirt.
Yes, blue shirt.
Looks blue from here.
Anyway. Hi. In your predecessor, Tom Daschle, apparently it was an attempt at assassination attempt shortly after 9/11. He was mailed anthrax, which, as I recall, actually came from the Fort Detrick biowarfare base. Senator Paul Wellstone died under suspicious circumstances. Senator Carnahan's plane fell out of the sky. Is there anything that you can... This sounds like I, Claudius. Is there anything that the Senate can do to keep Senate Democrats alive?
Well, I was in the Senate when I got the phone call about Governor Carnahan's plane going down. It was very bewildering. But at no time did I feel the pain that I felt when Pete Rouse, Daschle's chief of staff, called me and said, "We think Paul Wellstone's plane went down." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "No, I think his plane's down." And, of course, it killed him. And we have checked, and that was as a result of pilot error. It's pretty clear that's the case. We all have experiences. You know, this immigration reform thing has been very concerning to people that keep an eye on me. There have been numerous threats to me as a result of that, among other things. So we live in a difficult world here in America, when violence seems to supersede a lot of things, but we're doing our best. We feel very, very. It's unfortunate that Carnahan and Wellstone were killed in those plane crashes, but it's also a lesson to members of Congress: don't fly in airplanes that you don't know who the pilots are, or. And look out, and if it's stormy. I remember I was assistant leader at the time, and we were going down to do an event, political event in Georgia. Went into Dulles Airport. They took us, the weather was bad. They took us to, drove us to a place in West Virginia, and the plane's there. It's raining, wind blowing around. I walk out the pilot. I said, "How's the weather on the way down?" He said, "Extreme turbulence." I said, "Not for me." And that was the end of that little airplane to be ride. I think we just have to be more careful.
I would recommend the senator's book, if for no other reason than to read about the incident where, when he was head of the Nevada Gaming Commission, discovered that his car was wired with a car bomb, and how he responded in the weeks after. If there was any character builder, I think that's the one that I came up with the most. I think we should all applaud the senator for being here today.
Thank you to Dick, and thank you to Senator Harry Reid. If you would like to buy a book and get it signed, you can do so at the table upstairs. We'll see you up there.
So thanks, everybody, for being here. I appreciate your time. Also, remember the book. I don't make any money off of that. Don't count money to charity.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.